America's favorite Bible verse. Thou shalt not judge. They're not worried about murder. They're not worried about adultery. They're not worried about covetousness. But what they're worried about is that somebody judge them. Yet they judge us every day. The hypocrisy and, of course, the misunderstanding of what judgment is. As soon as you meet somebody, you judge them. You look at things about them and you make determinations about them. You judge them based on their appearance. And that's important, by the way. Because people are looking on the outward appearance. But God's also looking on the heart. You'll say, well, your church is judgmental. We hear that all the time. Well, every church is judgmental. They look at you and they make a determination based on your actions and based on your appearance, and they make a decision about the kind of person you are. It's just what it is. It doesn't have to be bad. It could be good. There's people I meet, the first time I meet them, I think, I like this person. There's a person of character. There's a person that has something to them. And so it's not always in the negative. It can be in a positive that we judge as long as we judge righteously. But we have a nation that doesn't want to be judged because her deeds are evil. We have a when I say church, it's lowercase c of Christianity, again lowercase c, religionists that do not want to be judged because they're going to come up short on the day of judgment. They're going to fall short of the glory of God. So you and I in the house of God tonight, we want to judge righteously. We want to judge the Word of God righteously because it doesn't matter what our thoughts are about it. It's only what the Lord says, and it's only His thoughts that are right. And so we want to be righteous in the things that we do. We need to be righteous one with another. The Bible talks in Isaiah, I believe it's in chapter 59, about judgment and equity. It uses that term several times through the Scriptures. Equity is absolutely fairness. You don't consider one above another because of their appearance, because of their background, because of their race, because of their gender. But you have equity towards them. You ought to hire a person based on the qualifications of the job that they're seeking. You ought to hire a person based on the fact that they have the character, you believe, to perform the job. And equity has fallen in the street. There is no equity. There's no fairness. You go for a job interview in the average company today, and you already have about 5 strikes against you because you don't meet certain qualifications that they have to have because the law has dictated that they have to have. It doesn't matter if you're the most qualified person. You just have to meet what the law says. And that's not equity. We come to the church house, it ought to just be a level playing field. We judge righteously. We ought to judge fairly. We ought to uplift one another. And we ought not to consider one above another, but consider all men above ourselves. Inequity ought to dwell in the church house where there's no upper class, middle class, and God forbid, lower class. Yet, most religion today, most esteem themselves in the upper class. To them, anybody else that's not them is the middle or lower class. I told Brother Donath last night, and maybe a few others, that after they got done singing, I was thankful I wasn't a Presbyterian, where everything is upper class, everything is top shelf. Some churches are more concerned about having scuffs on the pews than they are about having scuffs in the hearts of sinners. Church, we don't ever want to get away from that. I don't ever want to get away from that desire to see people come to know Jesus Christ. And you can go visit on the golf course all day long. You can go down and knock on every house on the golf course. It's not that the Lord doesn't love them. It's not that He's willing that they should perish. But most of them hide behind the doors of wealth that they've built. No concern over the things of God. You go into the highways and hedges, not taking it out of context. You go into highways and hedges. You find the blind, and for sake of illustration, the crippled and the crazy. You bring down to the house of God that God can work on their heart. And I've learned they're a whole lot more receptive to the things of God than those that consider themselves in the upper crust. I've learned at the church house, those folks are a whole lot more receptive than those that think they're somebody or think they're something in the eyes of God. I want God to take us these next couple of nights, when we've got a few services left, and help us to search our hearts and make sure we have this great salvation. And know that God is no respecter of persons. God doesn't save anyone because of their status in life. But God also does not reject people because of their status in life. He is a savior of sinners. He wouldn't have said that he wasn't willing that any should perish, but all should come to repentance, unless he meant this, that he's not willing that any should perish. He wouldn't have said that if it weren't for that. From the hills of Hollywood to the houses of Wall Street, he's not willing that any should perish. From the very ghettos and the slums of Chicago to the crystal meth addict of Black Creek, New York, he's not willing that any should perish. But it'd be a shame to sit in the house of God for years and then perish. Because of the hardness of our hearts, because of the deceit of our own heart, it'd be a shame to be raised in church and die and go to hell. I'm afraid all over this nation. I do want to give you one word of testimony, not to boast anything of us. But there is a young man whose last name I can hardly pronounce. It's Longagen Retten, like a Dr. Felter. When he got off the boat, his family got off the boat, they didn't bother changing their name to Schmidt. And so this young man's name is Nathan, and about 20 letters in his last name. So Nathan L. And we held a revival service, and some of you were there, down in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania. Some of you came into this meeting. We're thankful for that. And all week long, preachers were preaching the message God had given them. I preached several nights, but Zach preached tonight. And Nathan told us just the other week, he said, Brother McVeigh, he said, I was, that very week, he said, I'd read in the Bible, many shall come in my name. He said, many shall cry, Lord, Lord. He said, depart from me. He said, all week long I was wrestling with that. Lord, Lord. But he said, the Lord didn't know me. And I didn't know him. He said, Friday night the preacher got up and said, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in thy name? Do many wonderful works? And he said, that's me. That night he went to Brother Travis Clayton after service. He said, I need help with something. Brother Travis said, what do you need, son? He said, I don't know if I'm saved or lost. Brother Travis said, well, which one are you? And he just burst into tears. He said, I'm lost. Brother Travis said, why don't you get saved then? He knelt there in the side of the chapel underneath the overhang. Said he got born again by the grace of God. Right. Raised in church his whole life. Been around the preaching of the word of God his whole life. His daddy's a deacon in the church. He has a life of confusion. I'd say, I don't know how old Nathan is now, 35, 34 years old. So we're looking at about 30 years old when he got saved. And just confusion and torment, the turmoil. And he told me about the awfulness of the last several years of not knowing if he's saved, not knowing if he's been born again, not understanding, you know, am I really saved? Am I not saved? But he said he realized when he cried, Lord, Lord, that no one answered. I challenge you these next three nights. We're having revival. You can term what that is, whether it's a traditional term, whether it's something meaningful to us, that God will just renew us, revive us, bring us back to life, stir in us again. But I think that term revival means to bring to life. That God would revive some that are dead spiritually. Yes. I'm going to take a text tonight, and again, I take this very carefully. In 1 Kings chapter number 21, I feel very much impressed of the Lord to bring this out, but it's not going to be, I'll be honest, it's not that I've ever had anything flashy, but it's not going to be flashy, it's not going to be flamboyant, it's not going to be a barn burner. You probably won't put it on Facebook, Twitter, what else is there out there? All I have is junk out there. You probably won't post it anywhere out there. If you take a picture, please don't put it on Instagram. But I just want to preach what the Lord said about a few different things, and I pray it's a help to you. And here in 1 Kings in chapter number 21, verse 1, he said, "It came to pass after these things that Naboth the Jezreelite had a vineyard, which was in Jezreel, hard by the palace of Ahab, king of Samaria. And Ahab spake unto Naboth, saying, Give me thy vineyard, that I may have it for a garden of herbs, because it is near unto my house, and I will give thee for it a better vineyard than it. Or if it seem good to thee, I will give thee the worth of it in money." Naboth said to Ahab, "The Lord forbid it me that I should give the inheritance of my fathers unto thee." And Ahab came into his house heavy and displeased because of the word which Naboth the Jezreelite had spoken to him. For he had said, "I will not give thee the inheritance of my fathers." And he laid him down upon his bed and turned away his face and would eat no bread. But Jezebel his wife came to him and said unto him, "Why is thy spirit so sad that thou eatest no bread?" And he said unto her, "Because I spake unto Naboth the Jezreelite and said unto him, Give me thy vineyard for money, or else if it please thee, I will give thee another vineyard for it." And he answered, "I will not give thee my vineyard." And Jezebel his wife said unto him, "Dost thou now govern the kingdom of Israel? Arise and eat bread. Let thine heart be merry. I will give thee the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite." So she wrote letters in Ahab's name and sealed them with his seal and sent the letters unto the elders and to the nobles that were in his city dwelling with Naboth. And she wrote in the letter saying, "Proclaim a fast and set Naboth on high among the people." And set two men, sons of Belial, before him to bear witness against him, saying, "Thou dost blaspheme God and the king," and then carry him out and stone him that he may die. The men of the city, even the elders and the nobles who were the inhabitants in his city, did as Jezebel had sent unto them, and it was written in the letters which she had sent unto them. They proclaimed a fast and set Naboth on high among the people. And there came in two men, children of Belial, and sat before him, and the men of Belial witnessed against him, even against Naboth, in the presence of the people, saying, "Naboth did blaspheme God and the king." Then they carried him forth out of the city and stoned him with stones that he died. And then they sent to Jezebel, saying, "Naboth is stoned and is dead." And it came to pass when Jezebel heard that Naboth was stoned and was dead, that Jezebel said to Ahab, "Arise, take possession of the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite, which he refused to give thee for money, but Naboth is not alive, but dead." It came to pass when Ahab heard that Naboth was dead, that Ahab rose up to go down to the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite to take possession of it. And the word of the Lord came to Elijah the Tishbite, saying, "Arise, go down to meet Ahab, king of Israel, which is in Samaria. Behold, he is in the vineyard of Naboth, whither he has gone down to possess it. Now shall speak unto him, saying, Thus saith the Lord, Hast thou killed and also taken possession? Now shall speak unto him, saying, Thus saith the Lord, In the place where dogs lick the blood of Naboth, shall dogs lick thy blood, even thine. And Ahab said to Elijah, Hast thou found me, O mine enemy? And he answered, I have found thee, because thou hast sold thyself to work evil in the sight of the Lord." In verse number 25, the Bible says of Ahab, there was none like unto Ahab. Now we can stop there and shout the victory. There was no one like Ahab. No one could compare to Ahab, but the Lord said this, which did sell himself to work wickedness in the sight of the Lord, whom Jezebel his wife stirred up. There's so many thoughts really just running through my head I really want to leave Jezebel alone, although Jezebel is the root of a lot of this. He married a king's daughter, a Gentile king's daughter. She sought to work wickedness. She pressed sore upon Ahab that he would work wickedness. And then behind the scenes, she said to Ahab, "You're the ruler." And in context, she said, "I'll handle this for you." There was none like unto Ahab. There was no king ever like Ahab that sold himself to work wickedness. These next couple of nights, with the Lord's help, I want to preach on the thought of the price of blood. There is a price of blood. Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, wound for a wound. And here Ahab has sold himself to work evil. And the Lord said that the dogs shall eat him. Men today feel, I believe, that there will be no judgment. Because in this world there seems to be no judgment. There is no equity. There is no fairness. So if there were equity today, men might fear the Lord enough to realize that what the Bible said God would do, he will do. But because things are so out of kilter, people don't fear judgment today. They stand in the face of the judges of this land and they scoff and they mock and they curse and they ridicule judgment because they know that there is no equity. I sat in the courtroom one time. Some of you have been to the courtroom for different reasons. I was there because I came under judgment. I was driving down a side street in Maryland. And I turned the corner and I saw the righteous judge standing in the street. But it was too late. He already had the radar gun pointed in my direction. I couldn't escape the judgment. But in all equity, he did what he should have done. Though I pled and though I asked him for mercy and though I begged him to be lenient, he handed me a ticket. And he said this, "I'll see you in court." And I didn't go cocky and I didn't go arrogant. I went with the shame of anyone that has to go and waste their day in the court because of their foolishness and because of their own stupidity. And they know by the end of the day that you're going to be broke because of your own foolishness. And I sat in the courtroom and a man came in who had been caught selling crack cocaine. They had 7 or 8 people that had to stand before the judge. And this man had been selling crack cocaine and had run from the police and had wounded a police officer. His hand, I believe it was, when fleeing. And he was very rude to the judge and snide with the judge. And just, you could just tell that he had been there many times before. The judge knew him. He knew the judge. The judge banged his gavel down and he set his bail at $50. And that man walked out of the courtroom laughing. The next young lady stood in the stand and she was in there for just the same reason I was in there, for speeding. And she said, "Your Honor, I've never had a speeding ticket. I have never, you know, broken the law knowingly." And he cut her off and proceeded to yell at her in the courtroom about being a liar and about being deceitful, and pointed his finger at her and said, "You are a liar. You just got caught for the first time." And she cut him off and said, "Your Honor, I don't speed." He mocked her and laughed at her and then pounded his gavel and passed judgment on her. I believe, I want to say, in the realm of $200 to $250. And I was just sitting there thinking, how unfair is this? That the judge will unrighteously, easily release a man who's selling crack cocaine to the community and has hurt a police officer and has walked out of court so easily, and yet this young lady had the book thrown at her. And it dawned on me She's gone. But he's going to be back. It was $50 to get him out of the clique. But he had another date with the judge. So the judge was pretty lenient up front with him. But he's coming back one day and he's going to stand before the judge. And it's not going to be a hearing for what he's done. It's going to be judgment for what he's done. She pays her fine and she can go home and sleep in her own bed. Judgment wasn't speedily executed. He walked out of the courtroom. It wouldn't surprise me if he had rocks in his pocket, walked down the street and began to sell again, thinking that he got away with it. Ahab and Jezebel were people like that. I don't want to get into this too much, but I want to say America is a country like that. Ahab and Jezebel, there's two things with the Lord's help. I try to get through both these tonight, but I want to look at the price of covetousness. And then with the Lord's help, I want to look at the price of murder. The fact that they would not only covet, but they would kill to get what they wanted. If you will, let's look back here in 2 Kings chapter 9. If you're just, we'll turn and come back to our text just a little bit. But 2 Kings chapter number 9. I don't want to read this whole text because, Lord willing, tomorrow night we'll use this more. But the Bible said this. 2 Kings chapter number 9 and verse number 25. Then said Jehu to Bidkar, his captain, take up and cast him in the portion of the field of Naboth the Jezreelite. For remember how that when I and thou rode together with Ahab his father, the Lord laid this burden upon him. Surely I have seen yesterday the blood of Naboth and the blood of his son, saith the Lord. And I will wet with thee in this plat, saith the Lord. Now therefore take and cast him into the plat of ground, according to the word of the Lord. And I read this passage because I want you to realize that Naboth is dead because of covetousness seated in the heart of a man. In our text, we read how Ahab looked because this vineyard was hard up against the castle, so to speak, the house of the king. And the vineyard is there where he sees it probably every day. He has admired it, and because of greed, because he wants more, he has realized, I want that piece of land. But Naboth, having the character he had, he said, you can't have it. And in context, he said, my father left this to me. It's not for sale, and I'm not for sale. And Naboth goes back and turns to the wall, wouldn't eat bread. He's so distraught over the misery of not getting what he wants in life that when Jezebel comes into him, he, and for sake of illustration, he's laying there facing the wall, he's sucking his thumb, a little tear rolling down his cheek. And Jezebel comes in and says, oh, you're not the ruler. I'll get this land for you. So Ahab, because of the covetousness that was seated in his heart, then the tale goes on, and we understand, not a tale, I don't want to use that word lightly. The story goes on because it's a reality, and it's very real. To get what he wanted, he had to slay this innocent man, Naboth, who had done absolutely nothing to him, but it's because of covetousness. The love of money is still the root of all evil. People steal because they want. People murder most of the time because they want. Adultery is more oftentimes about power and greed than we would probably even begin to understand. Situation is coming in our lives with some folks we know well, a family we've known for 10 years, where I just suspect in my own thinking I could very well be wrong. But I suspect that mom and dad have destroyed a marriage because they want their little girl to marry somebody more successful. They don't want their little girl to suffer. They don't want their little girl to be without. So I strongly suspect they've intervened in a life and destroyed a marriage so their little girl could have more money. But what they don't realize is she'll have the money, but she's also going to have the misery that comes with it. This, and I want to say this very, very carefully, but no matter which side of the plate you look at this in politics, in this political season of elections, greed abounds. The talk of money is on everybody's lips. Most people are concerned with one thing in the election. I was amazed the other night. I wasn't amazed. I wasn't even shocked. I was appalled. During this awful debate, this heinous, despicable debate the other night, the two things that were paramount in the last election didn't come off the lips of either candidate. When your pastor and I talked, we both said it's because the battle's already lost. They don't even talk about abortion anymore because the battle's lost. They don't talk about gay marriage anymore. Why? Because we lost the battle. I'll tell you why. Because nobody was fighting the battle for us. That's why. It was all charade. It was all a smokescreen. It was all politics. They wanted gay marriage. They got gay marriage. They've wanted abortion because there's money in abortion. There's money for the doctors. There's money for the clinics. There's government funding. There's Planned Parenthood money. It's a racket for money. We lost the battle a long time ago. The Supreme Court will never visit it again. Why? Because of covetousness. When you call somebody a minority, people can make money because of that minority. It doesn't matter what the tag or what the reason for being a minority is. I'm waiting for my ship to come in. The married white male is becoming fast in American culture, is fast being done away with. Within 20, 30 years, American white married male. Let me throw that out there. Straight. He is going to become an anomaly. He's going to be an unusual thing one day. Hopefully then maybe my ship will come in. I'll be 74. There might be Social Security money. I might be getting $15, $20 a month by that time. And I'm not trying to be mean about that. But everybody says, well, you know, we let's classify this as a minority. Why? Because there's those that can make money off of it. There's gain. There's profit. And I'm not going against those that were oppressed by the government and oppressed by people and their lives were ruined by the government and by others. But those that would make merchandise off the people of America, and my friend, greed is the name of the game because of covetousness. And the people love it so. Why? Because when politicians talk about gain, that's all people want is gain. Who can make me the wealthiest? Who can provide me with the most money, the better jobs? Who can give to me the money? And the people say, well, let me choose a candidate that will bring the wealth into our coffers. And that's exactly how they vote. There's no other concern over any moral issue anymore. It's all whether or not we think this candidate can bring money into our home. Why? Because we're a nation of covetous. We're a nation of greed. I remember they played the sound clip many times in one of those talk radio stations that I used to listen to years ago. And they played the sound clip over and over again. They were asking people during this time when the housing crisis was spinning up and people were losing their homes at an alarming rate. And so many hundreds of thousands of Americans lost their homes because of what they called the housing crisis. And they were interviewing people about how could you cut corners? How could you shave off, some money and save money that you might be able to keep your house? And they asked this one lady in the streets, they said, what is one thing you cannot do without that you would not be willing to sacrifice to save your home? And her answer was, my nails. She would rather have her fingernails done than to keep her own home. That's what she was saying. And they played that sound clip over and over and over again until it just really got old and boring after a while. But she said, as long as I can keep my nails, it doesn't matter if I have a place to live. And that is the theme of America. That is the theme of religion. That is the theme of Ahab and Jezebel. The Bible said he sold himself to work evil. I don't have time to get into all that, but it's the underlying current that affects us. Just because the love of many has waxed cold. Why? Because iniquity abounds. We are pressed on every side. Now, don't think we're being hypocritical. My wife and I run a small business. It is a very small business. Some of you know that. And no, it's not back here on the table. We run a very small retail business. We try to run it honest. We try to run it fair. We try to not rip people off. We try to make sure that everything we do is with integrity. But we do it to make money so that we can have money to live on, such as pay the electric bill, pay the phone bill, the internet bill so we can keep our business going, pay the mortgage, pay our taxes. But the idea behind our business is that we can sustain ourselves as we are. It is not to push us into a better lifestyle or a higher way of living, that our lifestyle now exceeds what we're bringing in. The last thing Aboth needed was another vineyard. And I'm going to say this with kindness, and you know, I hope most of you right now know, church, that we do love you and care about you. But the last thing most of you need is more money. What most need is to learn how to spend the money they have wisely.
That's right.
If I just had a little bit more money, you'd blow it.
Sure.
That's right. Ask the furniture stores. January 30th, I got my tax check. What's the first thing we do? We go buy piles of furniture. I'm not trying to be mean, I'm just being honest. They say car sales skyrocket, furniture sales skyrocket. People all year go along and they don't say, and finally the tax comes in, they squander it, and one day they spend it all. And 6 months later, what they didn't have cash for, the truck's back out in front, somebody's knocking on the door. And if it's you, just take it for what it is. Don't get mad at the preacher because he tells the truth. And somebody's knocking the door and said, we need the couch back. We need the TV back. We need the dining room set back. We need the car back. Now, some of you used to live like that. You have lifted up holy hands and thanked the Lord. You don't live like that. Those of you that do live like that, you ought to thank the Lord that you're a preacher. And other preachers are willing to tell you the truth about it.
Yeah.
Covetousness. The desire to have things that are not yours. The desires of your heart to have gain. And supposing that godliness is gain. Supposing there's the gain is godliness, rather godliness is gain. Supposing that gain is godliness. The Bible tells us later on, from such turn away. Why? Because there are those that think that because you have money, because you have wealth, because you have prosperity, because you look right, and boy, things are just going good, oh, God must really be blessing them. Ask Jimmy Swagger. Ask Kenneth Copeland. Ask Joyce Meyer. Just go down the list. They would say, yes, because of my living for God, God has so blessed me. Well, how come he hasn't blessed the millions of people sending their lottery money into them? That's all that is, by the way. It's no different than playing a scratch-off ticket. They send the televangelists money. Why? In hopes that they'll get a return on it. It's just like buying a scratch-off ticket. I think I'm going to scratch this off, and I hope this will change my life. We were at Speedway gas station not too long ago, and a fellow's in line in front of me. And he had one of the big tickets. You know, the more they cost, the bigger they are. So somehow the state's invested, 2 cents in this huge piece of cardboard. And he hands it to the girl, and she scans it. She says, oh, you won. And I have my drink and just a drink and a donut. Oh, man. And I set it down on the counter in hopes that he'd buy it. And I stood back and watched, and she said, I guess you want the cash. He said, no, just give me more tickets. I said, okay. Here's what he said. He said, unless it's 20,000 or more, it ain't going to help me anyway. I thought, you could have taken that $5 for that ticket. You could have invested in any number of endeavors that would have profited you. But you invested it in a piece of cardboard in a hope that your life would change for the better. how foolish,
yeah.
How simple.
Yes, sir.
But you realize that even in the house of God, there's people that aren't gambling with lottery tickets, but they're gambling with their finances because they want gain rather than godliness.
Yes.
God has blessed many. You ought to thank the Lord for it. 5 years ago this week, a man stood in this pulpit, and what he said is something I had to really take to heart. He said, a rich man, he is despised by many people because of his wealth. But he said, a poor man never gave me a job. I said, well, thank the Lord then. I worked for a man who was an Iranian immigrant into the United States. He worked from the ground up in a technology company. As an Iranian immigrant, was able to get a low-level security clearance. And on his own, he struck out in 1985, I believe it was, and started Artel Incorporated. The day that he interviewed me, I sat in his office, the CEO of a top 500 small business corporations in America. He's in the Washington Post top 100 minority-owned small businesses in America. And that man sat there and interviewed me, sitting across his desk. He had earned every single penny he made. He worked his tail off to earn that money. And he propped his foot up on his leg. Brother John, you might appreciate this. And he had a hole this big in the bottom of his shoe.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to laugh. His son, Yaziz, told me one time, I just was curious. I said, how much is the company worth? He said, well, the company's worth about $140 million. I said, how much of that share is your dad's? He said, probably about $100. He drove a 25-year-old BMW. Mercedes. He had a hole in the bottom of his shoe. And was I supposed to despise him? Was I supposed to have contempt for him? Look at him and his Mercedes Benz. And look at him with his $4,000 Italian loafers with a hole in the bottom of them. But yet the greed of so many comes out of a life that just seethes with bitterness because of bad financial decisions. But more than that, it's the love of money that's rooted in hearts. Jezebel sees her husband sad. It wasn't out of sympathy. I don't know if Jezebel had a sympathetic bone in her body. It wasn't out of sympathy that she entreats Ahab. It was out of the greed. I'll get you that vineyard. Don't you worry. We'll own that vineyard one day. Ahab couldn't understand this. I'll give you another vineyard like unto it. But I want this vineyard. So he went. He cried. He pouted. His wife comes, comforts him, and then does what it takes to get the vineyard. Because of covetousness. Paul said he had not known sin. And I know you know this one. Your pastor uses this verse all the time. Except the law, it said, thou shalt not covet. Lust in his heart revealed sin to him. That I am lusting, I am thirsting after these things. I'm desirous of more. I remember very well, I just used this illustration, knocking on a door in Easton, Maryland, one of the Chesapeake Bay neighborhoods on the other side of the bridge. 5 miles up the road, down at Rumsfeld, Condoleezza Rice, several Hollywood actors had their summer homes in the Chesapeake Bay. We're knocking a door in this neighborhood in this stately, what I would call a mansion. And they opened the door and let us come in. And we're stepping into the foyer of this probably 5,000 square foot home. Beautifully appointed with woodwork and trim and beautiful cabinets in the kitchen back in the corner. And there was no furniture in the front two rooms. And they said, come in. And I went back into the back where they were, and there's a leather sectional And like a family room, dining room, kitchen combination, there's a leather sectional, there's a monstrous television, DVDs from the floor to the ceiling, about 500 DVDs probably in the corner, and a kitchen and nothing else in the room. I thought to myself, how silly. I said, did you all just move in? The man kind of shamedly said, no, we've lived here, and he told me, I believe, two and a half years. But to buy a mansion and not even be able to put furniture in it, how silly. To impress somebody you don't even like, even sillier. To show your neighbors how wealthy you are, how foolish. Let's put a pool in the backyard and we'll put a tarp on it, spray paint it blue so they think there's water in the pool. Let's shop where the emperor got his new clothes so we can impress everybody with our fashions. But it's the facade of life. It's the front of life. The putting on of airs. As long as everybody else knows I'm something. As long as everybody else thinks good of me and well of me. As long as I can put on a show for people. Whatever it takes to sustain my lifestyle and sustain my appearance. And maybe even people down at the church will think I'm somebody. I had a new car. Once, most of you saw it. It was a blue Toyota Camry I bought brand new. And I went to the dealership. I was making a little bit more than I'm making in evangelism, about five times more. And I'm not being funny. And I walked into the dealer and we haggled, we talked, and I got the car for under invoice. I knelt at the steering wheel. I said, Lord, I want to use this car for your honor, for your glory. And I want you to be a blessing to others. And I pulled out of there my brand new, and you all never saw that car, but the brand new Toyota Camry. It had 13 miles on it. It has 470,000 now. It lives in Blaine, Pennsylvania. Has redneck seat covers and a camouflage license plate holder. I did not approve of that. I didn't have any say in that. I sold the car to Ricky. But when I drove off the parking lot, I told the Lord, I'll get, you know, donate, dedicate this car to you. Whatever you want us to do, Lord, I'll use this car for your honor, for your glory. It might not have been that Sunday night. It was in a week or two. But the Ron Shank calls me up and says, Brother Tim, I need you to pick up a family in Hagerstown. My first thought was, in my new car. Bear with me. I know you are more spiritual than me. And I was trying to think of whose car I could borrow. And it still smelled new. It looked new. At that time, I didn't even eat in it. Since then, I've devoured thousands of McDonald's sandwiches in that car. And I remember going to the town just thinking, I hope they don't have children because, you know, there's always bottles and, you know, gummy bears and goldfish crackers. And I thought, I pulled up and this red-haired lady comes out. And that's four little children. I had four seats in the car. The Christian thing would have been to done to tell her, listen, I only have four seats. There's five of you. You don't have any car seats, so I can't do it. That would have been the Christian thing to do. But the Lord said, I thought you were going to use this car for my glory. So I said, lady, push those children down on the floor where nobody can see them. And we're going to get out of town as quick as we can. Now, some of you wouldn't like that. That's okay. I didn't have a choice. She pushed her children down the floor. They sat on the back floor of that Camry. She sat up on the seat. There was somebody else with me. So there's four children laid in the back seat. We drove to church. And nobody wet the floor. Nobody smeared goldfish and mashed potatoes on the seats. But I realized that there's some things that I thought I loved people. But I found out there's some things in my life that maybe I even love more than my neighbor. That's a pretty horrible thought. Me put somebody in my house? Me put somebody in my car? Me give somebody, you know these people are leeches. I wouldn't give them money for anything. They're just leeches on society. But if you see your brother have need and you shut up your bowels of compassion, he said, how dwelleth the love of Christ in you? What is shutting up your bowels of compassion? That's when you just shut them up and you say, I'm not giving because I'm not going to be taken advantage of. Your pastor talked about that, I believe, last night. This is mine. I earned this. I own this. This is, I worked for this. He doesn't deserve that vineyard. I'm the ruler of the people. I'll take the vineyard. Let me just take a cheap shot real quick. That's what a lot of pastors do today. They see their people have nice things, and all they think about is, how can I get that from them to benefit me? We doing okay? I've heard story after story of pastors who have milked their people for cars and lands and houses and gain and profit. Knocked on the door. Probably 15 years ago. It's a cold, snowy night. I remember it well. It's kind of mad she didn't invite me in. I said, ma'am, from the church, my name's Tim McVeigh. This is whoever's with me. We began to talk. She said, well, I got saved back in 1960-something. She said, I can't go to church now because of my health, but I love the Lord. And she said, I just stay home, read my Bible, and pray. The church comes to visit. She said, she goes, I can't go out without a wheelchair. And she goes, I go to church maybe 2 or 3 times a year. But she said, it's been awful tough on me. And I began to just talk to her a little bit. And then she said this, she stops me. She said, but I don't watch those television preachers. I said, well, that's good, man. That's a blessing. She said, they're on there asking people for money. She said, my pastor taught me you put tithe in the offering plate at your church. She said, I still mail my tithe to the church because I can't go, but that's my church. She goes, I would never, this is a lady in her 80s, she says, I would never send somebody on TV money. I said, lady, you got a whole lot more sense than the world. You'd be amazed how people shut up their bowels. I don't want to get into all this, but we're kind of here now. But they shut up their bowels of compassion because they look on the outward, they judge unrighteously, and they really don't see what the need is. And if you remember in that story, there was a certain Samaritan. That was for certain. This isn't just a story Jesus told. It was for certain. Religion walked down one side of the street. The clergy walked down on one side of the street. They saw him laying there bruised and beaten in the ditch. They wouldn't do a thing to help. So who comes along, the Samaritan? And what's the first thing he did when he saw him? He had compassion. And how dwelleth the love of Christ in us if we shut up our bowels of compassion? Some of you may remember this. I don't remember a lot of things. I do remember this. At that point now, just being tired and traveling a lot, plus getting older now, my stories are all the same. I just need new stories. I need to start reading, Folks in the Family or something, trying to get new stories. But I remember on the Windsor Bridge in Detroit, and it's a shipping channel, so you're guessing at least 120 to 130 foot above the water, minimum. And on the news, people were in an uproar because a young lady had been murdered and thrown off the bridge. Not in that order. Her boyfriend had drug her out of the car in front of traffic, in front of over 40 onlookers, and beat her to a pulp. Then he took her over the side of the bridge in front of all those onlookers and threw her over the side of the bridge. And she died. And the news got eyewitnesses from the police. The news was on site. The police basically stopped the bridge, detained people. The district attorney wanted to press charges, but he realized he couldn't press charges against all of them because there were people that were incapacitated. There were grandmothers, people that could not have helped. And because of equity, he couldn't charge just the men who didn't help. It wouldn't have been right. So he didn't charge anybody. I remember watching the television and watching those news stories come across and people saying the same thing, everyone the same thing. I wish I had have done something. But their bowels of compassion were shut up a long time ago. Most people respond to the little baby at the prayer car with a fly stuck on his eyeball and some rice falling out of the corner of his mouth. Why? Because the eye affected the heart. And that'll stir their heart. All those poor children in Africa, all those poor children in Indonesia, all the starving, maybe we can do something to help them. But what they cannot see is the people that live next door to them that are in far worse condition than that little child in Africa. You say, how could they be in worse condition than that little child in Africa? Because they live in the breadbasket of the world and they're spiritually starving. I was taught, like some of you, that you are a liberal, that for use of a better word, you are a compromiser if all you do is try to feed people. I was taught that. But it's okay for us to have big banquets to feed ourselves. Amen. As long as we fed us, it was okay. As long as we had a Christmas. Now, I'm not exaggerating. Missions banquet, Valentine's banquet, well, sweetheart banquet. You know, we were that at least that saved. Mother's Day banquet, father-son banquet, 4th of July picnic, anniversary banquet, fall harvest banquet, Thanksgiving banquet, Christmas banquet. So at least 9 a year banquets. It was okay for us to feed ourselves. In fact, the church put a lot of money into that to make sure we were fed. But the thing what I was taught is you just don't feed these people because then you're just a handout and you become a handout to them. And so we would feed ourselves but not feed the community. You know why? Because people show up their bowels of compassion to evidence that the love of Christ does not dwell in them. Why? Because they're covetous. I'm saving for, and you can fill in the blank. I need a new, and again, you can fill in the blank. Covetous. I want burning desire for things that don't amount to anything. Some of you know we dabble in, no, junk. I don't know a better word, but we dabble in junk. I'm amazed at people that overlook quality because it's shiny. They'll overlook a Jamestown, New York wire cutter set. Honestly, on eBay, $35-$40. Why? It's Jamestown, New York. It's real steel. And I watch people go past and ignore it completely. And they'll go down there to get those cheap Chinese wire cutters and pay $5 for them because they're shiny. And time again. I had a friend that the askers know, some of the others know, Mason comes here this summer. His father, my friend, is my friend Phil. And he gets all these tools at auction and he loads up and I ask him, I said, well, what did you sell? And he says, cheap Chinese junk. And I don't mean to be insulting. It's just that the junk that comes out of China is exactly that. It's cheap Chinese junk. It's made out of recycled cars. American-made tools used to be, they would have steel mills in these towns, in Buffalo, in Jamestown, across Toledo, in Cleveland, Pittsburgh. Then they would make the tools on the spot. Why? Because it was real steel made right there, and they had good quality tools. The Chinese melt our cars down, ship tools over here. They're shiny. They break the second time you use them. I'm not exaggerating that. But people love them because they're so shiny. You know what Walmart does to us? They make the appearance of looking good, and people just have to have because it's shiny. It's new looking. It's fancy. Wow, look at that. And the decorations and the little pieces and little trinkets. And they thrive off selling trinkets. Why? Because they know that Americans can't keep their hands off little trinkets. They got to buy, they got to own, they got to have, they got to decorate, they got to change. Everything's coming and going. Everything's passing. Fashions come and go. Styles come and go. Everything changes. Everything's different. And for you to change, you have to spend money to make the change happen, because they know we're a covetous society that follows the fashions of this society. We follow the acceptable things of this society. People spend big money to fit in with this society. Some Hollywood harlot dyes her hair, and all of a sudden America begins to dye their hair. Some sports star styles his sideburns, and all of a sudden every young man that's in high school, college age, he has the same sideburns. Doesn't matter what it is. I will say this, I'm not pandering to anybody, but at least BCGs have never been in fashion, Stephen. Just letting you know that. Amen. Some of you don't understand, that's okay. Some of us understand. BCGs are those glasses they give you in basic training. I just like to pick on Stephen about that. Why? Because people are following all the fashions, all the trends. Can I tell myself for something? I got these glasses, and I had to get glasses replaced because the ones they gave me just corroded. And they had a one-year warranty. I called eyeglasses.com. The lady said, we'll send you a new pair of glasses. I said, okay. She said, pick out some frames. So I went through, and I picked out HD like 204. And I got them, and I put them on, and I wore them. And I was in church one day, and some young man goes, do you drive Harley Davidsons? I said, no. He goes, well, why do you have Harley Davidson glasses on? I went, oh, that's what that says. Real face, it says Harley Davidson. I mean, I look like a biker, don't I? I wasn't trying to fit in. It wasn't a fashion statement. I wasn't trying to, you know, be so cool at school. Man, I got Harley glasses. You know, I can tout that from the pulpit. You know, let you all see, you know, I'm a Harley Davidson. I got cufflinks, Tim. Look at that. Oh, I got my cufflinks today. Well, the reason why is because my cuff falls down to here if I don't put them in. That's why I wear them. And it flops around my wrist. But you'd be amazed how many people, that's their show, that's their statement, that's trying to identify who they are about the bling and about. I've said this before, and I'm not trying to mock. I'm not trying to be ugly about this. My wife and I just, we commented and we tried to, well, she's very nice about it. I'm not. There's a man preaching one day, and he's, and I'm not trying to mock. And some men are just more fashion oriented than others. We just sell shirts. I care less about the fashion. I don't care if you buy an ugly shirt. My wife's even said that. She goes, honey, we can't sell that shirt. It's ugly. I'm like, well, take it to church. I don't care. And some of you have been recipients of them, amen. And so this man, he's preaching. I'm not trying to mock. Before that, he has a vest. He has the black suit. He has the polished shoes. He's got the trendy glasses. He has a great big diamond ring here, a great big diamond ring here. When he goes like this, his cufflinks come out. You can tell they're very blingy cufflinks, unlike mine, who are at a box lot, probably about worth 10 cents. He's got the blingy tie chain across here. And he had a Rolex, and I don't think it was a counter. He had a Rolex watch on. Now, I wouldn't think anything about that if he didn't have a chain that went over from his fob and went down in his little pocket on his vest. And when asked the time, he pulled his pocket watch out and flipped it open. And I can handle a lot of a man. But when he's wearing a watch and a pocket watch, it just went a little too far for me. I'll just be honest with you. Synchronize watches now. Click, click. Now, church, let me say this. I promise I'm done. It's not just those things. That man could be absolutely right with God. I just tell you that with a little bit of levity. It's just that most people are just covetous, and they're not right with God. There's a desire and a burning in their heart. Ladies, I don't think like a lady. If I did, then things would be really odd. But the reality is that ladies, I believe, sit there a lot of times and look at their husband. And they think, you know, if he just was this, 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 or this, how much better it would be. You know what that is? Covetous. If I just had a better husband. If I just had a better looking husband. I'm just throwing that out there. Men, I know we don't, it doesn't faze us. We don't ever think that, I know. But if we did, what an awful thing. If my wife was just better looking. Now, it would be impossible for me. Some of you, maybe you could have a better looking wife. I can't. I mean that. It was a shady maple smorgasbord. Our pastor jokingly, affectionately calls it the Baptist Mecca. It's near Lancaster, Pennsylvania. It's a typical Pennsylvania Dutch smorgasbord, and it is the mother of smorgasbords. I think it's 600 feet long, and I've eaten every inch of it. Just throw that out there. And we were in the smorgasbord. Only I said the wrong one. We were at Miller's. And there was a woman trying to get my attention. I don't mean that because I'm good looking or strapping or have money or anything. She's just a Jezebel. She's wicked. And she's trying to get my attention. And the Lord smote my heart so strongly. Don't look at her. And she, my wife even noticed. She'd walk by. And I just said, okay, Lord. Look up here. Look this way. It wasn't in my flesh to do that. After 15 minutes, they finally see to this. My wife made a very sweet comment about, you know, I don't know what that wicked Jezebel is trying to get your attention for, something like that. You all know the good side of Rebecca. She said, she looked at her several times disdainfully, you know, ladies, some of you know, they look at the skirt, they look at your clothing, just that disdainful look. And the Lord very clearly smote my heart with this. If you had have looked at her, it would have given credibility to everything she's doing. Because if you had have made eye contact, this is what the Lord smote my heart with. If you had made eye contact with her, it would tell her you're better than her. I said, okay, help me to learn from that, but help me to teach others too.
Amen.
Men, I'm not saying it's not easy. But if you don't look,
right,
you won't long for it.
Right.
If you don't look, and I say this kindly to ladies, to my wife, if you don't look, you won't think you're missing something.
Right.
And by the way, most of them, you're not missing anything anyway because they're showing the world. Covetous seeds in the hearts of so many. And the snare to us that the devil has set before us is when he tells us you can have that and it won't cost you anything. And I'm not going to get ahead of myself in this, but I'm going to tell you this just quickly. It cost David a whole lot. It cost Ahab a whole lot. It cost Jezebel a whole lot. And it cost Jesus Christ his life. Our wants and our desires need to be in the bounds of this book. They need to be centered in the very center pages of this book. Lest we be snared by covetousness and lust in our hearts for the things that we don't have. I've worked with rich people. And they had more problems. And we all say this. They had more problems than anybody I know. I mean rich people. And they had more problems than anybody I knew. There are more rich parents taking their children down to the high dollar dry out clinics, probably percentage wise, than there are middle class. You know why? Because their children see the covetousness, and their lust knows no bounds in their life.
Right.
Because their parents' lust has no bounds. The average person that is, when I say rich, I'm talking about just rich. The average person today that's rich has a marriage that's based on money. And as long as the money satisfies both, I've learned both parties usually live separate lives and do what they want to do. Because the only thing holding them together is that money. And how miserable. How awful. How filthy. Well, John, I'm done.
Pastor Hayden.
Yes.
That's your service.
we don't have any lunch today?
No.